Hello, welcome back for another episode of the Shark Snippets podcast, the bite-sized podcast for anyone who loves or wants to learn about sharks, skates and rays. My name is Josh and I'm a marine biologist who specialises in shark ecology. This week, I'm really excited to begin with one of my favourite species of ray, and that is the giant oceanic manta ray, often referred to as the giant manta. The giant manta ray is one of two manta ray species, with the other being known as the reef manta. There is actually a potential third species, however genetic analysis is still ongoing and it is not 100% confirmed yet. The giant manta ray has large triangular shaped pectoral fins, which are commonly referred to as wings, due to their flight-like movement. Also, unlike sharks, their gills are on the underneath of their body, and the giant manta ray can grow to a humongous 7 meters or 23 feet across from one wingtip to the other, with the average being around 5 meters or 17 feet. And there are actually even anecdotal reports of them being up to 9.1 meters, which is the equivalent of 30 foot. They can also weigh up to 2,000 kilos or 4,409 pounds. Giant mantas are believed to mature around 4 to 4.45 meters or 13 to 14.8 feet for males, and 5 to 5.5 meters or 16.4 to 18 feet for females. And just like humans, they give birth to live young, and a newborn giant manta can measure between 1.2 to 1.5 meters or 3.9 to 4.9 feet, which is massive. It's believed that giant manta rays are relatively long-lived and estimated that they can live to around 40 years old. The giant manta ray is found in tropical, subtropical, and temperate waters in all the world's major oceans. It has been recorded as far north as Southern California in the Pacific and New Jersey in the United States. In Japan and Egypt, and as far south as Peru, Uruguay, South Africa, and New Zealand. The giant manta is capable of diving to a depth of 1,000 meters, or around 3,300 foot, and is even often seen breaching or jumping out of the water and landing with a loud splash, which some scientists have hypothesized is a possible form of communication or even play. With oceanic in its name, the giant manta is thought to traverse the vast distances across the open ocean, and it appears to be a seasonal visitor to coastal and offshore sites. Like the whale shark or the basking shark, the giant manta ray is a filter feeder. This is where the animal filters the water and consumes the tiny plankton found within it. And often, when feeding, the giant manta rays will swim in a slow somersault motion, which makes for an absolutely amazing underwater performance. If you have ever seen a picture of a manta ray, the oceanic or the reef, you will know that they have these paddle-like lobes at the front of their mouths. And these are known as cephalic lobes. These lobes form a funnel-like structure which helps channel plankton-rich water into their mouth for them to consume. These lobes are known to fold in a spiral form when they are not feeding and just swimming. Manta rays have a unique pattern or a series of spots on the underside of their bodies or bellies. And these patterns are used by scientists to distinguish individuals, because just like our fingerprints, they are unique for every single manta ray. Also, an interesting fact is that manta rays actually have the largest brain to body ratio of any studied fish, and it's thought they have highly developed cognitive abilities. The giant manta ray is classified as vulnerable on the IUCN Red List and has been traditionally harvested for its oil, rich liver and skin. With old commercial fisheries occurring in eastern Australia and the Sea of Cortez around Mexico. Although occasionally taken in local fisheries for food, it has become a sought-after species for the traditional Chinese medicine trade, where it is believed that by eating the manta ray's gill rakers, which is the part of the animal that filters the water to obtain oxygen and the plankton that they eat, it will boost your immune system by reducing toxins and enhancing blood circulation. This, of course, is not supported by science. The giant manta is also often caught as bycatch due to their average low swimming speed, well-known aggregation sites or the places where you can find them, and they also spend most of their time at the surface. All of these factors unfortunately contribute to them often being caught in bycatches of purse seine nets, for example. There are a few renowned locations to see the giant manta ray, with one of the best being Sirocco Island off of Mexico, the Simeon Islands off of the west coast of Thailand, and also Rajampat, where you can see both species. I'm starting off the Sharks in the News section with probably the most distributed shark news story of the week, and that is about a suspected white shark sighting near the Spanish Balearic Islands in the Mediterranean. This story has been going round multiple news outlets, and the supposed white shark was spotted from the Alnitak, I think that's how you pronounce it, the Alnitak, which is a research boat which is currently travelling round the Mediterranean collecting data on turtles, sperm whales and other marine wildlife. Now, if you don't know, it might come as a shock, but yes, great white sharks can be found in the Mediterranean. Historically, they've been caught by fishermen. However, particularly in the last 20 or 30 years, there have been very few sightings. And actually, if this sighting is 100% confirmed, it would be the first time that a white shark has been seen in Spanish waters since the last confirmed sighting in 1976. Unfortunately, with the Mediterranean Sea being so heavily populated, it has suffered hugely from overfishing. And sharks in general, and particularly the white shark, are one of the species that have been really heavily affected by this. To the extent that white sharks and most other sharks in the Med are often considered a myth. Interestingly, the great white sharks found in the Mediterranean are completely different populations to those found in the Atlantic, and are incredibly more genetically related to the Australian population of white sharks. Currently, I've only found one picture of the white shark, which was originally posted on the research boat's Facebook page. I'm always personally skeptical on stories like this, and unfortunately, in my opinion, the picture provided is not clear enough for me to distinguish it from a mako shark, which are also found in the Mediterranean. The research group have also released a video, but again, it's not clear in the footage, and if anything, it kind of looks more like a mako. This has more of a thinner body and a really wide section at the tail, which is common in mako sharks. I really hope that they release more footage so that I can truly determine, and I'm sure others, if it is a white shark. And I really, really hope that it is, and that it's not mistaken identity, because as I think with most shark research scientists, we'd love to see a resurgence in the population in the Mediterranean. If you have seen the picture or video associated, I would love to hear your thoughts, particularly if you really, really do think it is a white shark and not another species such as a mako. Please tweet me or drop me an email. The second article that I'm going to discuss is titled Feeding Frenzy. Public accuse the media of deliberately fueling shark fear. And this one kind of links in slightly with the last article. And just because it's been doing the rounds and the different media outlets can be, they can vary in terms of what they like to portray. And wherever you are in the world, whether it's Africa or Australia, news stories always want to instigate emotion and grab you with catchy or interesting titles in order to get read. Unfortunately, to do this, many journalists like to exacerbate and exaggerate the topics or events, and sharks are definitely one of these. A great example of this, like I just said, is the article actually with the video of the supposed white shark off of the coast of Spain. So the title of that article states, "Terrifying footage emerges of giant great white shark stalking the coastline of Brit's holiday favourite Mallorca." So using words such as terrifying and stalking are really almost laughable in this instance. There's nothing terrifying about the footage, unless you think that a fish swimming normally in the ocean where it lives is scary. It's literally no different to watching a cow walking on or in a field. Well, it might be a slight exaggeration because cows aren't necessarily that scary compared to sharks. However, statistically, you are still more likely to be killed by a cow than a shark. So the question is, should they actually be considered more scary? And then the journalist, or should I say storyteller, must be blind if he thinks that the shark is stalking a boat. If you haven't seen the footage, then please click on the link in the description. But if you're not going to, then basically the shark is actually in front of the boat. And so the boat is actually chasing behind it. So I don't know how that could be considered stalking. Obviously, he does. But again, it's just a prime example of how many, not all media outlets, but many run stories like this to really kind of get you clicking and get you bringing in to bring in the traffic. So in the opening paragraph of this article, it states how last year the Australian Senate had evidence that media coverage has contributed to disproportionately high fear of sharks among the public compared to the actual degree of risk involved. And the important thing to take from that is the comparison to the risk involved, which is low. The article also highlights the emotive language that is often used to describe sharks, similar to, obviously, the stalking and, what one was it? Terrifying footage that, or words that were used in the last one. So some of the words that they've described or mentioned in the article are words such as killer, invasion, deadly, savage, horror, vicious, and monster. And the article actually states as well how it came to light that the media routinely uses stock footage of great white sharks, even when the story is on a different species. So in addition to to that, the article states how they ran a focus group of 67 people, including swimmers, surfers, anglers, tourists and conservation, and people from other backgrounds, to discuss shark mitigation and the general attitude towards sharks. And interestingly, many participants blamed the media for stoking fears of sharks in people. And this wasn't something that the survey was actually intended to try and interpret. So they also gathered and coded 6,000 shark-related comments from Facebook over a 13-month period from December 2015 to the end of 2016. Of the 259 comments that referred to the media, they found out that 8% were categorized as positive, 18% as dissatisfied, 42% as hostile to the media, and 15% judged the media as untruthful or unreliable. Now, that obviously kind of leaves 17% left. However, I'm not entirely sure what that 17% is associated with, because unfortunately it's not stated in the article. So there were actually also some positive comments where people saw the media's presentation as being balanced. And two of these outlets included Coastal Watch and The Guardian. The article states that from their study, there was a widespread view that the media routinely exaggerates, distorts, and beats up shark stories as a way to generate extra clicks, views, sales, and ultimately profits, which, like I mentioned earlier, I personally agree with. And the article gives some great examples of this. So the article also mentions one of the comments from the people in the focus group, discussing how due to drones, smartphones, and just general technology, sharks always having their pictures taken, and that people now perceive that sharks are more frequent than they actually are due to increased exposure, which I think is actually quite an interesting take on the situation and actually probably does hold some truth and relevance. So I really like the article, how it was written and how its facts were presented, and it's certainly worth a read. So as always, the links for the articles are in the podcast description. So the title of this week's paper for the Sharks in Science snippet is How Shark Conservation in the Maldives Affects Demand for Dive Tourism. This study was led by Johanna Zimmer-Hackel out of the University of Western Australia and the Australian Institute of Marine Science. The publication starts off with some nice background information on shark ecotourism and draws off some great previous studies stating how shark diving has increasingly gained popularity and is now attracting over 500,000 tourists to shark dive sites in approximately 45 countries around the world. Also, they've sourced some other good information on actual tangible amounts that shark ecotourism brings into certain countries. In Palau, shark diving amounts to $18 million in annual business revenue and $25.5 million in Australia. It's long been known that sharks alive can provide a continual return from tourism, especially compared to the one-time payment of a dead shark. The paper mentions that shark management strategies that fail or succeed in their conservation goals will influence tourist satisfaction, and therefore demand can have an important implication on local communities. The economic impacts, both negative and positive, to shark diving tourism are aimed to be quantified in the paper. To summarise the hypotheses, an increase in the quality of shark diving experiences through larger number of sharks, no illegal shark fishing, and more conservation will increase the demand for trips and therefore add more economic benefit. And on the flip side, a decrease in shark populations, more shark fishing, and a lack of engagement from operators will reduce demand and cause economic loss. The study site for this paper was the Republic of the Maldives and provided the perfect study location. This is because tourism accounts for a huge amount of the country's revenue. I mean, think about all of those adverts you continually see online, on Facebook or on Instagram, of a picture of paradise just pop up. And also in 2010, the Maldives created a shark sanctuary. And this was actually due to the old shark fishery declining shark populations and threatening their tourism economy. Also, scuba divers have complained about observing illegal shark fishing during dive trips, and many dive operators within the Maldives engage in some form of shark conservation. So to test the hypotheses, a survey was created and 19 different dive operators agreed to conduct the surveys with their clients. The dive operators consisted of 7 on resort islands, 11 on local islands, and 1 on a dive cruise boat. The survey consisted of 5 sections. The first section was about the reasoning or visit of visiting and the importance that sharks played in their decision to visit. The second was their satisfaction with the shark diving experience. The third was about future planned visits to the Maldives in the next 10 years under the status quo scenario and 7 alternative scenarios. These scenarios were shark fishing being absent, shark fishing being present, an increase in shark abundance, an overall decrease in shark abundance, sharks being completely absent, conservation present, and conservation absent. The 4th section of the survey asked about travel costs, and the 5th section was about general demographics, so things like gender, age, and nationality. A total of 341 dive tourists were approached by the researchers, and after everything, it resulted in 300 valid surveys that could be used for the study. Approximately 60% were men and 40% were women, with an average age of 42, and an average annual household income of $87,617. The average spend per person to the Maldives was $3,937, and people on average were staying 11.9 days, spending 6.6 days diving, with an average of 13 dives. 74% of the survey group visited the Maldives primarily to dive, and for them, seeing sharks, it was only the main reason for 5%, and very important for 24% of the respondents. Out of the 300 respondents, 40 of them observed shark fishing or shark trade during their time in the Maldives. So, for the survey scenarios, the average number of return trips per 5 years were calculated, and for the status quo, the average number was 1.63. And then for each of the different scenarios, it was also calculated. So actually, with an increase in shark abundance, it increased the average to 1.88. And also, if conservation was present, that increased it to 1.74. However, a decrease in shark abundance dropped it to 1.16. Conservation being absent dropped it to 0.94 trips per 5 years. Then 0.815 trips per 5 years for sharks being absent. And then if shark fishing was present, a whopping 51.1% said that they wouldn't return at all to the Maldives. And out of those that would, the average trip per 5 years was calculated to be 0.71. And compared to the 1.63 of the status quo, it's a huge difference. So from the other parts of the survey, particularly the amount spent per trip, the individual consumer surplus was calculated. And so that actually represents the overall value of a diving tourist and what that diving tourist brings in terms of money-wise to the Maldives. And then from each individual one, they were combined and calculated to give the overall value in millions of US dollars per year that dive tourists provide or could provide under the different scenarios. So, as some conservation does happen and no legal fishing occurs, they were removed from the comparisons. So for the status quo, kind of the control or the standard, it was calculated at 380.45 million US dollars per year was the value. And then it was calculated that if there was to be an abundance, an increase in abundance of sharks, then that would also increase the value to 439.23 million US dollars per year. So quite a sizable increase. However, if abundance decreased, the overall value would drop to 270.07 million. And if conservation was completely absent, then the overall value dropped to 220.18 million US dollars per year. If sharks were just completely absent, then it would drop to 188.13 per year. And if shark fishing was present, then the suspected overall value was only 166.45 million US dollars, which is just over a 56% reduction compared to that 380.45 from the status quo, which is huge. That would be a huge loss in revenue and economy, especially when you rely so heavily on that industry. So whilst there are definitely some variables within the study, they're all found within the discussion section. I mean, the results and the calculations really speak for themselves. And it's clear just how economically advantageous it would be to actually even just increase the shark abundance in the Maldives. And I mean, quite interesting as well, the paper did actually state that they think that it could probably be applicable to other smaller countries or island states like the Maldives, where shark tourism is so key. So yeah, just a really nice little paper, being able to put some nice figures and some nice values to sharks, really, and how important that this ecotourism is, as long as it's run appropriately and that there are real conservation benefits that aid in the abundance and the numbers of sharks. So thanks again for listening. And if you have any questions or that you want to put to me regarding this episode, then please let me know. Shoot me a message on Twitter or via email. As per always, the links are in the podcast description. Thanks again for listening. I hope you have a jawsome week, and I will catch you in the next one.